You charmed us, you challenged us, you dazzled us and inspired us. So confident and free to be yourself. So encouraging of others to do the same.
Hey everybody, what's up? It's Shelby with Hooks, Books, and Crime. And it's Craft and Story Time. I don't think I say that on every episode like I'm supposed to. But yeah, that's what this is. If you're not crafting, you're not crafting. That's fine. Just happy someone's listening. But really, yeah. I'm doing things differently today because I realized no matter how I angle my camera without it being like super far out, and my stupid fucking stand broke, my son broke it, and I'm really not in the mood to buy another one. I've bought like 4 already, and this is my favorite one. I don't want to replace it, at least not right now. But, yeah, like you couldn't really see what I was doing. I'd have to like crochet like this, which is very uncomfortable. I look ridiculous. I can't crochet that way. So what I'm doing now is I'm going to record it and I'm just going to put it like, you know, somewhere on the side, like, you know, where's my finger? Like over here. And you can see what I'm making. What I'm making is my favorite, for me, the most iconic 90s character. Impacted me way more than I should have been impacted by her. Definitely to a fault. It drove my mother crazy, which was even better. It was, you know, bonus points. I was pissing her off. Because I was one of those girls. So, the story I have for you today, it's a great story. It's, as usual, you know, it's heartbreaking. It's actually very heartbreaking, especially because I've heard the 911 call. It's terrible. But I'm kind of annoyed because I was covering the story, right? And then I saw that there's this new show on Investigative Discovery. Because I haven't been watching a lot of true crime stuff, only because I've been watching Mom on Netflix with Anna Faris, and it's hilarious. I did not expect it to be funny, mainly because I think Anna Faris is annoying. She gets on my nerves. I blame Scary Movie. Like every time I see her in something, all I can picture her is doing that dumbest laugh, and I just can't do it. But she's hilarious in this. But I honestly, most of the credit has to go to Allison Janney. I don't know anything that she's not good in, to be honest. She's hilarious in this. But, it's called A Murderer Among Friends or something like that. And I was looking at it and I saw that they're only 4 episodes deep. One of the episodes, like the second episode, is the story I'm covering. I'm like, oh, well, great. So now I'm going to look like I didn't watch it, though. But I was like, oh, great. This is what I'm covering. But, I mean, true crime's true crime. We're going to overlap. And they got way more attention than I do, so that doesn't matter. Anyway, okay, so we're actually in summer of 2013, which for me, oh my god, I had just had a baby. No, like my daughter would have been turning 1, my oldest. She would have been turning 1 a month from when this occurred. But we are in Hartford, Wisconsin. Like, y'all, Wisconsin's got a lot of murders. Like, what does the snow do to y'all? Well, you know what? I can't even blame the snow because Florida exists and they got a lot of crazy shit going on over there too. But we can blame the humidity, I guess? The alligators? I don't know. But, so yeah, we're in Hartford, Wisconsin, which really looks like it's so pretty. Honestly, I guess because for me, like anything up north, it looks super pretty. But it's because I'm in San Antonio, Texas. It's all right here. People say it's beautiful. The Riverwalk is pretty at night. It's just very, you know, flat land. Hill country's beautiful. I love the hill country. I'm not in the hill country. One day, though. One day. Now, so it's summer 2013. We're in July. And Jesse Blodgett is who we're talking about. And Jesse Blodgett is a 19-year-old college student. She actually attends the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee. She's a theater major. And honestly, I wish I would have joined theater, honestly. I had those kind of parents and cousins. And so I grew up on a ranch with my whole family. Like, I make jokes that I grew up on, like, a Catholic commune because it's basically what I grew up on. And everybody was very superficial, so I got grounded for not being in athletics. And don't join ROTC because that's who losers. That was for losers. And theater was for losers. And basically, so I chose not to do anything. And I missed out on a lot of camaraderie. And I think that would have I think there would have been a lot of character development for me there, rather than me just not doing anything and getting in trouble. So I definitely wish I would have done theater. Not necessarily for the acting and everything, but the writing would have been great. Honestly, just being a theater tech. I didn't know that was a thing. Being a theater tech and building shit, that sounds awesome. I would have most definitely wanted to do something like that. That sounds awesome. But yeah, so she's a theater student and it's the summer, so she's back at home. And I think I don't think she was in dorms, but you know, she's at home for the summer and she's doing community theater. And the show that they're actually going to put on is Fiddler on the Roof, a theater classic in which she is playing the fiddler, which I know nothing about the play, but considering Fiddler is in the title, I'm assuming this is a major role. I'm assuming. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I already said I don't know, so I don't know. It's an assumption. Now, this girl has a great group of friends. They've been friends since high school, and they're very close-knit, and they are good friends. They're really, I mean, I wish I had these friends at that age, or even in high school. They genuinely care about each other's well-being. Nobody's really drifting apart, and everybody seems to be there for each other. And her friends are, if they aren't in, because they were all very artsy, whether it was in theater, music, any medium, really, they were all very artsy and very talented from what it seems like. They all brought something to the table and to this group to where, I mean, that just sounds so cool. They can come together and just create. That just sounds so fun. So if her friends aren't in the play with her, they're in the audience supporting their friends. And then, so they have this performance. July 14th is the date of the play. After this play, they have a cast party to celebrate and, you know, blow off some steam. First show's done. All of that stress, you can kind of just roll off your back now and you can enjoy yourself again. It's done. So they're having a cast party. Her friends are there. They're having a good time. Around 1 o'clock, her and her friend, Kelly, head out. They head home. Jesse drops Kelly off at her house. And then Jesse arrives at her house, at her own home. We know Jesse gets home safely. She comes inside. She talks to her mom for a little bit, or for both of her parents, I believe. And then she goes to bed. So that next morning, on July 15th, Jesse's mom leaves for work around 8 o'clock. Her father's already at work. And then, you know, it's 8 o'clock. Her mom knows that she was out late, so she doesn't expect Jesse to be awake. And when she checks on her, she's not. She's definitely sleeping. So, you know, isn't worried about it, and she leaves. Now, she actually called Jesse later on. She didn't answer, which still wasn't too concerning. But as time progressed, she never called her back, and she wasn't responding. So at noon, around noonish, lunchtime, her mom, whose name is Joy comes home to check on Jesse. And what she walks into in Jesse's room shatters her world. Jesse is cold to the touch. She looks like she's sleeping, but around her neck is a very obvious strangulation mark. And her hair's wet. Someone's definitely been in this house. So her mom calls 911 and I can already feel myself welling up with tears. Because, you know, she's telling them that she just looks so gone and it's just heartbreaking because, you know, it's so much to process while you're trying to talk to someone and call for help. But she says, honey, what happened to you? And it's just so heartbreaking. I hate 911 calls. I do. I hate them so much. And I try to avoid them. But I got curious just because of the whole, you know, her coming home from lunch. and checking on her, so I pulled it, and her just, honey, no. It's rough to listen to, that's for sure. Ugh, I'm sorry. And also, I'm sorry if I look like I keep looking at my face. I hate how I look right now. I did a very light makeup, and oh my god, my age is just there in my face. It's like, Shelby, we're not in our 20s anymore. Ugh. So, I'm sorry if I keep looking at my face, but I'm literally like, should I pause this and go put on eyeliner and, you know, actual foundation and everything and do more? But no, this is me. No, that was terrible. Might cut that. Anyway, so her mom calls the police, EMS, and the police arrive, but she's dead on arrival. They try to bring her back, you know, chest compressions and everything, and it's just, nothing's working. She's gone. Jesse Blodgett is dead at 19. Now, in this investigation, you know, her father comes, and that's heartbreaking as well, because he's not allowed to see his daughter. By the time he arrives, police are there, so her room is a crime scene. And, you know, it's a crime scene. As much as you want to get in there, it can't be tampered with your presence, footsteps, just, you know, the dead skin cells falling off of you. Can't have that in there now, because this is important. And he understands that, I'm sure. It's just hard. It's a hard pill to swallow. So, they look around and whoever did this to her cleaned up, because they can't find too much. But what they do find is a journal. And Jesse seems to be an avid journal. Seems to be an avid writer, I would say. She likes the journal, and she seems consistent with it. I guess that's the best way to put it. Now, as they're reading this, you know, the cast party is mentioned, and in there she writes, and her friends kind of confirm this too, and this is what she talked to her mom about the night before. Some guys were getting a little inappropriate, maybe a little too close, a little too flirtatious, that she wasn't very comfortable with. And both of them being much older. Remember, she's 19, and these men are in their 40s. You know, they could be her father. So, that definitely rubbed everybody the wrong way. However, they were ruled out pretty quickly. They had alibis, and they were able to just scratch them. And this is what I mean about Jesse having great friends. As this whole commotion is going on at her house, one of the friends drives by and sees all the police cars at Jesse's house. So he starts sounding the alarm to all their friends. They start sounding the alarm to all their friends. And nobody can get a hold of Jesse. So they just show up. And that's when they learn that their friend's gone. And I really can't imagine being hit with that kind of news. Especially if you were with them less than 12 hours ago. You know that they were fine. And I have no doubt that this circle of friends were the kind of friends where, text me when you get home. Let me know you got home okay. I have no doubt that this was that kind of friend group. Which means they got that goodnight text also. Hey, I made it here. She got home around 1. I'm assuming maybe she went to bed around 2-ish. 10 hours later, she's gone. It's awful. I can't imagine what you have to do to come to terms with that mentally. And this was a big day the day before. There was so much light and love and celebration. All for it to just circle down a drain into this. But these kids are here. They show up to Jesse's house. And they console her parents. Jesse's an only child, which makes this so much harder. They lost their only child. So they're there and they're consoling Jesse's parents, and everybody's just sharing stories about her and being together, which I bet you her parents really appreciate that, because all they have is each other right now and they're falling apart. And then you have this great group of friends come and try to bear the weight with you. And you get to see firsthand how much love surrounded your daughter. The amount of love. I have no doubt that maybe not at that point. Well, I feel like even at that point too, it's a comfort. There was so much love. Your love for her was insurmountable. And then just compounded with more love. I just think that's so, I don't even know her. And for me, it brings me like a peace about what happened to her. Because when we get to what happened, it's, as usual, you know, it's senseless. But, so, they're going through this diary, and they're asking around, and they're going to have to question all her friends at some point. But as they're looking into everything, and like I said, there's no evidence, so it's really hard for them to find something to go off of. However, the investigators, they're in Hartford, they get a call. And this call comes from another area. I want to say Richfield. Also in Wisconsin, from what I understand, a little bit over 10 miles away, so not very far at all. They have 3 days before Jesse's death, so on July 12th, a girl was actually, she went to the park, and she, you know, she walked a trail, or she went to run, I believe. Which, I mean, I love trails, but this is a perfect example why I'm terrified to go alone. She, you know, and that's the thing, she makes it through the whole trail. She gets out of the woods, and as she's walking to her car, suddenly she hears something, and it's gaining on her. And as she looks back, it's a guy with a knife, and he just tackles her. He full-on attacks her right then and there. They're wrestling, and this girl, remarkably, is able to get the knife away from him. And that spooks him. She put up way more of a fight than he expected. And he leaves. He takes off. But this girl, luckily also, aside from defensive wounds from the knife on her hands, she's fine. She's physically, she is okay aside from her hands. She's able to give a very detailed description of the assailant, the car he's in, which is a blue van. I believe it's a Honda van, it's a Honda van. And I believe she got the license plate. And when they give this, as she gives this description, one of the officers who's in the interview recognizes the van because he had been patrolling that park or another park. He had been patrolling a park a few days before that and saw that van and, you know, just decided to run it just in case. So he has the information of who this belongs to. So as he pulls it and it comes back to an older couple, this older couple has a younger son named Daniel. Daniel Bartelt. He goes by Dan. Well, lo and behold, Dan is actually at Jesse's house. He's in her friend group. Dan is Jesse's ex-boyfriend from high school. They dated a little. They break up and everything, but they remained friends. They're all part of the same circle. And if you've ever been in that situation, you know you have to find some common ground and learn how to get along. even if that means completely not talking to each other. Just don't be an asshole. That's, you know, they, but as it is, it seemed like they were friends again. You know, they were able to be cordial, be cool with each other without letting feelings get in the way. You know, what happened then happened then. So the investigator in Richfield calls the investigator in Hartford and tells them, you know, what they have. And Dan, the guy's just like, oh my God, he's in her friend group. And he comes up in the journal a few times. There's an entry from her saying that Dan threw her for a loop. Or was it for a loop? That Dan, basically, he threw her off because at one point they were hanging out and he tried to kiss her. And she was kind of just like, nope, that's not happening between us anymore. So, you know, full on denial. Sorry. So they start looking into Dan. What as it is, they go ahead and call Dan in for questioning for the attack on the girl before Jesse. And I mean, when he's called in for questioning, he's at Jesse's house. And he just lies and tells them that it's some type of mistake that he just has to go sort out really quick. And Dan was considered such a good kid to Jesse's parents. Their names are Joy and Buck. He's considered like a good kid. He's a straight A student. And he's always been welcomed in their house. So when he's called, they kind of don't even question it. Because to them, of course Dan wouldn't do this. Obviously, it's not Dan. To them, they have no reason to be concerned with him being called for this. So Dan goes to be interviewed. And in this interview, you know, they're talking to him. And he says that the reason why he did this was because he wanted to scare someone. But this isn't like he was being menacing and standing in a corner just to scare her or make her uncomfortable. This dude fucking attacked her. And like, he knows. You can just see it in the investigation, in the interview. There, he knows that there's no explaining this one. So he just gives them that reasoning that he wanted to scare someone. And he's arrested right then and there. But before he's arrested, they go ahead and mention, as it is, when they talk to him, he thinks he's there for Jesse first. Which I guess I get because he's friends with her and her ex-boyfriend. But I don't, well, never mind. I guess it makes sense because, never mind, ignore me. Because it wouldn't make sense for him to think the other girl if he's trying to get away with it. Never mind. So, and as it is, he tried to lie about it and be like, no, I don't know why and everything. And then they basically give him everything. And he's like, okay, I wanted to scare someone. Like, okay, Dan. Okay. So they ask him, what do you think happened to Jesse? They bring her up anyway, just to see, because clearly, how odd that one girl's attacked and he failed. And then 3 days later, a girl he's very well acquainted with is dead. They aren't exactly obviously connected, but it's most definitely an avenue that needs to be looked at. Especially if he was able to just act like nothing happened after he attacks someone. So when they ask him, you know, what do you think happened to Jesse? He responds with, well, I think she was raped and murdered. Well, Daniel, the police never put it out to the public. They kept it within their investigation that Jesse was raped. Nobody knew that. Her parents didn't even know that, probably. They kept it, or maybe they did. I don't know. Why am I saying these things? Those are my assumptions. Good God. But, you know, the general public did not know this fact. Only the killer would know this. So with that comment, they really call the Hartford police and tell them, like, hey, he said this. And that's when everybody was just like, well, shit. All signs are pointing to Daniel Bartelt. So now that they have this information, or they know that he obviously knows something, they call the investigators in the Hartford and Jesse's, in the investigation of Jesse's murder. And now they come and question him. He's already in custody. When they come to question him, Dan gives his story of, yes, they were friends, but he says that they were starting to see each other as more as friends again, just secretly, because he was dating another girl and was afraid to break up with her and hurt her feelings, which, what crap, really? And this is all discounted by their friends also, because at one point he was trying to be like touchy-feely, flirtatious with Jesse, and she rejected him again. Not obvious and rudely, but, you know, her friends could see the line drawn, like, no, don't do this to me. We're not like that. So they know he's lying. And as they start to question him more, you know, he starts crying. But as he's crying, it's like, clearly, this is a theater kid. He's just not that great of an actor. He's making crying sounds, but there are no tears coming out of this kid's face. So, got you there. And so when they ask him, like, okay, well, where were you the day that Jesse died on July 15th? He says he was at Woodlawn Park. Well, great. Woodlawn Park has cameras. And clearly, Dan is actually on camera. You can see him going into the restroom. He was at the park. But when seeing this, another officer, I mean, quick thinking is just immediately says, we need to check the trash. He could have been there disposing of evidence. We need to check the trash. So that's their next step. They go and pull all the trash from that park. Lo and behold, in a cereal box is rope, duct tape, even like alcohol wipes to clean off blood, and if the grossest one, a makeshift ball gag made out of duct tape. But the rope and ligatures are the same size and same width as the mark around Jesse's neck. So all of this is collected. At this point, they seize the car, they seize his laptop, they actually find a book called The Interpretation of Murder, which is based off of a murder by strangulation, red flag there. And in his laptop, they find, I feel like this is so cookie cutter with a lot of these kids. It's always the kids. It's never the adults, it's the kids. Or like, you know, the young adults. He's been Googling a bunch of serial killers. Ted Bundy. I can't remember the others. I only remember Ted Bundy. I want to say John Wayne Gacy, but I don't think that's right. But, you know, the Night Stalker. He's looking at all of them. And he also has this disturbing video of a man who breaks into a woman's house, attacks her, rapes her, strangles her, and then washes her before he puts her back. Remember I said that Jesse's hair was wet? It confused her mom. Her mom mentioned it because she was very confused as to why her hair was wet. Almost as if she had been cleaned, because like I said, the room had been cleaned. Her bedroom after she was murdered had been cleaned. He put her back in like she was asleep. It's very methodical. Gross. So they have all this evidence and they send the what's in the cereal box to forensics. And this kid is still denying. You know, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. Crying. But you can never argue DNA evidence. What came back on everything found in that cereal box? There are only two people's DNA found on this, on all of it. Daniel Bartelt's and Jesse Blodgett's. So with that, it's his final nail in the coffin. Daniel is arrested and charged with first-degree murder on July 31st of 2013. And, I mean, really, this kid just, what a dick, really. So, they go to trial. Her friends are there. Their friends are there. They were his friends, too. Their friends are there, along with her parents. And so what police believe happened, before we get to the court and everything, what police believe happened is July 15th, Joy, Jesse's mother, leaves for work. And around 10 a.m., because that's around the time of death, estimated around 10 o'clock in the morning. So somewhere around that time, because Daniel was so acquainted with this family and this house and their rituals, he knew the front door was going to be open. It's the kind of neighborhood these people are in. You can leave your front door open. Which, honestly, I just want to know what that kind of safety feels like. Even when I lived in the country, I couldn't do that. I was just, we were too scared. He knew this family's rituals, their do's and don'ts. He went inside the house, went upstairs to Jesse's room, and attacked her. He raped her. He tied her down first, raped her, strangled her, possibly washed her, and put her back to bed. That is what investigators believe happened. That is what the evidence has led them to believe has happened. This whole thing was based on the motive of rejection. And I mean, the friends saw it. It's in the journal. Rejection was definitely there. And, you know, Dan just can't handle it. That, you know, sometimes a girl's just not going to like you anymore. That's just how it goes. And so they go to trial. He never fesses up to this at all. He's found guilty, but yeah, he never, everything stacked against him and just pointing at him and making it very clear that he did not cover his tracks and he is going to reap what he sowed. Instead, this shithead says some, when he addresses the family, he's like, everything's poor me, you know, like, I can't remember what he said verbatim, but something along the lines of him, he's going to have to be alone with his thoughts in a tiny cell. Well, bitch, you fucking did this. Yeah, you're going to be in a tiny cell. Be glad you're not in Texas. We might have killed you. Well, the death penalty takes too long, but I mean, death row just still sounds scary. But I said death row takes too long and I might piss off some people. I most definitely think that there are some people who are so fucking awful and so devoid of humanity that they are not owed the humanity. I'm just gonna say it. I don't. There was that prisoner, what, a year or two ago around here, that he escaped prison, murdered a family and their fucking kids. He had already murdered a bunch of people. Fuck that guy. Fuck that guy. I don't care. I don't think he deserves any humanity from us. I don't. I think we could put those resources elsewhere. So, just want to get that out there. So yeah. He's going to be in a tiny cell. Oh well. You did this to yourself. Now, he also said, this is the part that's just like, ugh, go to hell, Daniel. Go to hell. He said something of, though the jumpsuit and the shackles and the evidence make me look guilty, they don't mean I'm guilty. Or no, that this jumpsuit and handcuffs don't make me guilty. It's like, no. Okay, but you're there for a reason. Because everything literally pointed at you. And you attacked a girl a few days ago. Like, there's literally nothing else pointing at it. And again, why are y'all committing dumbass crimes with cameras still? I don't get it. I don't. Why are we doing this? It's ridiculous. So, he's sentenced to, I believe, life in prison. Yeah. He's sentenced. That little shit's not going to get out for a long time, if he gets to. Now, I really commend Jesse's parents in this, and I feel like a lot of the strength, again, comes from her friends and just how many people loved Jesse. They hold no ill will to Daniel's parents, and I'm going to post the clip in here of what the dad says, what her father, Buck, says about that.
Nobody won. Dan's family is a beautiful family who provided a loving environment. They're great people.
I feel like that just tells you what kind of wholesome upbringing she had to have that kind of mindset in the darkest, or if not the darkest, time of your life. I feel like that just speaks volumes of the household she grew up in. I mean, I feel like just the fact that she could talk to her mom at 1 a.m. when coming home from a party. I couldn't do that with my mom. She probably would have just yelled at me. And you know, they even started a foundation for her. It's called the Love is Greater Than Hate Project that her parents start. And its focus is to end violence against women and young girls. And, I mean, of course we can all get behind that. Crimes committed against everybody, but for some reason, because we're considered feminine, and for some reason people view feminism as a weakness, some men just come for us instead of picking on someone their own size. And her family just spreads love and light through everybody, and she's still celebrated amongst her friends and everything. This is a girl who died way too soon. And, you know, her parents had the burden of burying their child, which no parent should have to go through. It's my biggest fear. And through all of that, they still had community. They still have community. Can't think of where else to go with this. I'm just thinking about all that, and just, I really just can't stop thinking of how much love there is for this girl. She was taken way too soon from everybody. And I feel like the amount of love she shared with everybody was something that needed to stay here. Most definitely. I think a lot of good would have come from her. And it's a real tragedy that a rejected ex-boyfriend felt that he wanted to hurt someone. He failed the first time, and he felt like Jesse was perfect to be the next. It's disgusting. What a gross fucking dude. Fuck you, Daniel. Sad. But with that, I thank you for being here with me today. This is a short one. I'm actually kind of impressed that I remembered all this. Usually I'm like cutting so much because I have to check my notes. I still had to a few times, honestly, because I felt like I remembered this so smoothly, even though like my talking doesn't seem smooth, but in here it was, I swear. Verbalizing is different than thinking for me. I feel like that's for a lot of people though. But yeah, I remembered it so well that I feel like I had to check my notes and it was coming out, so I was remembering it so well that I checked my notes to be like, did I really remember all of it? Am I missing anything? But surprisingly, I am not. I'm not. But yeah, I'm still working on this, my 90s project. If you can figure out who I'm creating, I'd love to see who your idea is. What's in here, though, shouldn't give you enough. But yeah, I feel like, like I said, I'm going to do this whole 90s thing. This first one is like my favorite. I already have an idea for my second and third one, so. And actually, I think the third one's not even 90s, but it's nostalgia for me. So. I'm excited. But yeah, I thank you for joining me today. Please like, subscribe, follow, share. I wish y'all the best, and I'll catch you on the next one. Okay, bye.